3. Striking the proper constitutional balance here is of great importance to the nation during this period of ongoing combat, but it is equally vital that our calculus not give short shrift to the values that this country holds dear or to the privilege that is American citizenship. It is during our most challenging and uncertain moments that our nation's commitment to due process is most severely tested, and it is in those times that we must preserve our commitment at home to the principles for which we fight abroad. The imperative necessity for safeguarding these rights to procedural due process under the gravest of emergencies has existed throughout our constitutional history, for it is then under the pressing exigencies of crisis that there is the greatest temptation to dispense with the guarantees which, it is feared, will inhibit government action. It would indeed be ironic if, in the name of national defense, we would sanction the subversion of one of those liberties which makes the defense of the nation worthwhile. With due recognition of these competing concerns, we believe that neither the process proposed by the government nor the process apparently envisioned by the district court below strikes the proper constitutional balance when a United States citizen is detained in the United States as an enemy combatant. That is, the risk of erroneous deprivation of a detainee's liberty interest is unacceptably high under the government's proposed rule, while some of the additional or substitute procedural safeguards suggested by the district court are unwarranted in light of their limited probable value and the burdens they may impose on the military in such cases. We therefore hold that a citizen detainee seeking to challenge his classification as an enemy combatant must receive notice of the factual basis for his classification and a fair opportunity to rebut the government's factual assertions before a neutral decision maker. An essential principle of due process is that a deprivation of life, liberty, or property be preceded by notice and opportunity for hearing appropriate to the nature of the case. Due process requires a neutral and detached judge in the first instance. For more than a century, the central meaning of procedural due process has been clear. Parties whose rights are to be affected are entitled to be heard, and in order that they may enjoy that right, they must first be notified. It is equally fundamental that the right to notice and an opportunity to be heard must be granted at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner. These essential constitutional promises may not be eroded. At the same time, the exigencies of the circumstances may demand that, aside from these core elements, enemy combatant proceedings may be tailored to alleviate their uncommon potential to burden the executive at a time of ongoing military conflict. Hearsay, for example, may need to be accepted as the most reliable available evidence from the government in such a proceeding. Likewise, the Constitution would not be offended by a presumption in favor of the government's evidence, so long as that presumption remained a rebuttable one and fair opportunity for rebuttal were provided. Thus, once the government puts forth credible evidence that the habeas petitioner meets the enemy combatant criteria, the onus could shift to the petitioner to rebut that evidence with more persuasive evidence that he falls outside the criteria. A burden-shifting scheme of this sort would meet the goal of ensuring that the errant tourist, embedded journalist, or local aid worker has a chance to prove military error while giving due regard to the executive once it has put forth meaningful support for its conclusion that the detainee is in fact an enemy combatant. In the words of Matthews, the process of this sort would sufficiently address the risk of erroneous deprivation of a detainee's liberty interest while eliminating certain procedures that have questionable additional value in light of the burden on the government. We think it unlikely that this basic process will have the dire impact on the central functions of war-making that the government forecasts. The parties agree that initial captures on the battlefield need not receive the process we have discussed here. That process is due only when the determination is made to continue to hold those who have been seized. The government has made clear in its briefing that documentation regarding battlefield detainees is already kept in the ordinary course of military affairs. Any fact-finding imposition created by requiring a knowledgeable affiant to summarize these records to an independent tribunal is a minimal one. Likewise, arguments that military officers ought not have to wage war under the threat of litigation lose much of their steam when factual disputes at enemy combatant hearings are limited to the alleged combatant's acts. This focus meddles little, if any, in the strategy or conduct of war, inquiring only into the appropriateness of continuing to detain an individual claimed to have taken up arms against the United States. While we accord the greatest respect and consideration to the judgments of military authorities in matters relating to the actual prosecution of a war and recognize that the scope of that discretion necessarily is wide, it does not infringe on the core role of the military for the courts to exercise their own time-honored and constitutionally mandated roles of reviewing and resolving claims like those presented here. Like other claims conflicting with the asserted constitutional rights of the individual, the military claim must subject itself to the judicial process of having its reasonableness determined and its conflicts with other interests reconciled. What are the allowable limits of military discretion, and whether or not they have been overstepped in a particular case, are judicial questions. In sum, while the full protections that accompany challenges to detentions in other settings may prove unworkable and inappropriate in the enemy combatant setting, the threats to military operations posed by a basic system of independent review are not so weighty as to trump a citizen's core rights to challenge meaningfully the government's case and to be heard by an impartial adjudicator. Section D. In so holding, we necessarily reject the government's assertion that separation of powers principles mandate a heavily circumscribed role for the courts in such circumstances. Indeed, the position that the courts must forego any examination of the individual case and focus exclusively on the legality of the broader detention scheme cannot be mandated by any reasonable view of separation of powers, as this approach serves only to condense power into a single branch of government. We have long since made clear that a state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens. Whatever power the United States Constitution envisions for the executive in its exchanges with other nations or with enemy organizations in times of conflict, it must assuredly envision a role for all three branches when individual liberties are at stake. It was the central judgment of the framers of the Constitution that within our political scheme, the separation of governmental powers into three coordinate branches is essential to the preservation of liberty. The war power is a power to wage war successfully, and thus it permits the harnessing of the entire energies of the people in a supreme cooperative effort to preserve the nation. But even the war power does not remove constitutional limitations safeguarding essential liberties. Likewise, we have made clear that unless Congress acts to suspend it, the great writ of habeas corpus allows the judicial branch to play a necessary role in maintaining this delicate balance of governments, serving as an important judicial check on the executive's discretion in the realm of detentions. At its historical core, the writ of habeas corpus has served as a means of reviewing the legality of executive detention, and it is in that context that its protections have been strongest. Thus, while we do not question that our due process assessment must pay keen attention to the particular burdens faced by the executive in the context of military action, it would turn our system of checks and balances on its head to suggest that a citizen could not make his way to court with a challenge to the factual basis for his detention by his government simply because the executive opposes making available such a challenge. Absent suspension of the writ by Congress, a citizen detained as an enemy combatant is entitled to this process. Because we conclude that due process demands some system for a citizen detainee to refute his classification, the proposed some evidence standard is inadequate. Any process in which the executive's factual assertions go wholly unchallenged or are simply presumed correct without any opportunity for the alleged combatant to demonstrate otherwise, falls constitutionally short. As the government itself has recognized, we have utilized the some evidence standard in the past as a standard of review, not as a standard of proof. That is, it primarily has been employed by courts in examining an administrative record developed after an adversarial proceeding, one with process at least of the sort that we today hold is constitutionally mandated in the citizen-enemy combatant setting. This standard, therefore, is ill-suited to the situation in which a habeas petitioner has received no prior proceedings before any tribunal and had no prior opportunity to rebut the executive's factual assertions before a neutral decision-maker. Today, we are faced only with such a case. Aside from unspecified screening processes and military interrogations in which the government suggests Hamdi could have contested his classification, Hamdi has received no process. An interrogation by one's captor, however effective an intelligence-gathering tool, hardly constitutes a constitutionally adequate fact-finding before a neutral decision-maker. That even purportedly fair adjudicators are disqualified by their interest in the controversy to be decided is, of course, the general rule. Plainly, the process Hamdi has received is not that to which he is entitled under the Due Process Clause. There remains the possibility that the standards we have articulated could be met by an appropriately authorized and properly constituted military tribunal. Indeed, it is notable that military regulations already provide for such process in related instances, dictating that tribunals be made available to determine the status of enemy detainees who assert prisoner of war status under the Geneva Convention. In the absence of such process, however, a court that receives a petition for a writ of habeas corpus from an alleged enemy combatant must itself ensure that the minimum requirements of due process are achieved. Both courts below recognized as much, focusing their energies on the question of whether Hamdi was due an opportunity to rebut the government's case against him. The government, too, proceeded on this assumption, presenting its affidavit and then seeking that it be evaluated under a deferential standard of review based on burdens that it alleged would accompany any greater process. As we have discussed, a habeas court in a case such as this may accept affidavit evidence like that contained in the mob's declaration, so long as it also permits the alleged combatant to present his own factual case to rebut the government's return. We anticipate that a district court would proceed with the caution that we have indicated is necessary in this setting, engaging in a fact-finding process that is both prudent and incremental. We have no reason to doubt that courts faced with these sensitive matters will pay proper heed both to the matters of national security that might arise in an individual case and to the constitutional limitations safeguarding essential liberties that remain vibrant even in times of security concerns. Part 4. Hamdi asks us to hold that the Fourth Circuit also erred by denying him immediate access to counsel upon his detention and by disposing of the case without permitting him to meet with an attorney. Since our grant of certiorari in this case, Hamdi has been appointed counsel, with whom he has met for consultation purposes on several occasions, and with whom he is now being granted unmonitored meetings. He unquestionably has the right to access to counsel in connection with the proceedings on remand. No further consideration of this issue is necessary at this stage of the case. The judgment of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit is vacated, and the case is remanded for further proceedings. It is so ordered.